Hey everyone, welcome to your favorite podcast, Techish. It's your host, or co-host, Abadesi of Hustle Crew, and my other brilliant co-host,
Michael Pahane of Pocket and Techish in the house. Let's go.
This episode is sponsored by Small Data Industries. They safeguard the permanence and integrity of the world's artistic record by supporting and empowering people. They are hiring for an administrative coordinator based in Brooklyn, New York. Link for the position in the show notes.
All right, cool. So the first story is about a company called Brandless. I don't know if you've heard of them because they are brandless, so maybe you haven't heard of the brand. it was a direct-to-consumer play. Essentially, they were going to sell a whole bunch of like consumer goods, staples, food, like bathroom stuff, and it was all going to be brandless and it was all going to be direct-to-consumer. It was meant to be affordable, whatever. They've been going for 2 years. They've raised $240 million, and that number is going to be relevant in a minute. I'm going to explain. And they were from SoftBank. So SoftBank's a VC firm based out of Japan that's raised a whole bunch of money and invested a whole bunch of money. They've gone out of business recently. Now, they've made a statement saying, okay, yeah, the market's competitive and, you know, it's unsustainable for the business model. And, you know, they're going against Amazon. So obviously it's going to be difficult. Now, somebody on Twitter raised a fascinating point. Joe Spearman, great entrepreneur. He raised the point that, listen, I know so many black entrepreneurs that struggle to raise money, and they pretty much raised more than nearly all black entrepreneurs and founders in the last like recent years. And it's like, we're struggling to get this money, but D2C companies that are not necessarily even tech companies are raising the equivalent amount in one entity. And I Googled it actually. So black female founders raised $250 million in 2017, wow. Right? And Brandless, this company that went bankrupt now or shutting down, raised $240 million on its own. Now, I have thoughts. Make this make sense to me. Make it make sense to me. I don't know how to even tackle this whole subject.
I mean, this is so frustrating. It's funny because I just came from my friend's place in Brooklyn and he has all these brandless products in his bathroom. So I was just like, oh, interesting. But it's incredibly frustrating. I remember when Brandless first hit the market and had all this funding and everyone was like, oh, yes, this is exactly what millennials want. Millennials are rejecting the brands of previous generations. They want something that's affordable, minimalist, clean, etc. And I feel like SoftBank do not make good investment decisions.
Oh, you think, yeah?
But I mean, there's just so much cash to splash. And I kind of want to do a bit more digging about this because, you know, someone also put a tweet out saying like, is SoftBank just laundering money? Because these homies be writing checks like they're going out of fashion.
Yeah.
And I think it's more likely the fact that it's just been very easy for them to fundraise. Like apparently they went to like the Saudis and they just got like, boom, a check just like that. So anyway, they're just like finding, you know, regions where there's like a lot of cash and like bringing it to Silicon Valley. But I mean, that's probably worth another techish investigation. But, you know, this is ultimately depressing. For our community, it's depressing. The fact that the total sum raised by black women is equivalent to one single investment that a now fallen company has made is extremely frustrating. And I think a lot of people, to be fair, were kind of like not buying the narrative of when Brandless launched. Like, okay, so it's basically a brand that isn't a brand, and what else is unique about it? Because I don't think there really was anything else that unique about it. People were questioning the supply chain. People were questioning like, okay, well, is it more sustainable than a Procter & Gamble product? Is it more ethical? And, you know, they couldn't really answer those questions very well. And I think what you realized was ultimately, if you're going to enter a crowded space, you need to differentiate yourself in a way that's significant enough for you to gain market share. And they're competing in like a highly competitive space with like established companies like Unilever, like Procter & Gamble. And, you know, they were probably hoping, what, maybe to get an acquisition from one of those bigger brands. But, you know, if there's nothing unique enough about them, then how would that ever happen?
I think, yeah, it's just like I said with Casper, like if there's no differentiation, like what are you doing? Like, I don't see how you can justify all of that venture capital dollars flowing into it. I mean, I think I could sleep easy at night if I thought that $250 million number was going to like a SpaceX. Like, I get it. Okay, you're doing well, rocket ship to Mars. You need $250 million, right? But the fact that it's just going to a D2C play and it's like, yeah, I don't think it can be justified, you know, especially in light of that, the sum I mentioned for black female founders.
Yeah, I also
and
think,
actually, quickly about Casper, actually, I think they've now, if you remember a few episodes back, I ripped into them. Apparently now, like for their IPO price now, they've really like played it down and they've like the IPO target number they want to go for now is, you know, in single digits now. So I think we're going to see a lot. We've got a lot of high ranking Goldman Sachs officials listen to Tekish. They're like, okay, cool. People have spoken. Yeah, this ain't the one. And I think there's just going to be a lot of blood in the water with these DTC companies. I think it was a lot of hubris. I think they saw what happened with Dollar Shave Club.
Yeah.
What happened with Warby Parker. And a lot of Me Too VCs just backed a lot of Me Too companies. And that's my honest opinion.
Yeah. I also just feel that if I look at DTC companies that have been acquired by the, you know, by the OGs, you know, you have like Walker & Co. You have something which is serving an underserved segment of the market. And the thing about Brandless was, other than the fact that they didn't have a brand and were like maybe marginally cheaper, probably at the beginning, and later, you know, had to increase prices when SoftBank were pushing them to go to profitability, and then they lost even that as their competitive advantage. What made them different? You know, what made them different? And I think there's like a real lesson to be learned here about people that want to enter DTC, how important it is to be innovative, and how important it is to like also understand like realistically, what share of the market can you get? And I know a lot of investors say that when they receive pitch decks, this is one of the things that founders always inflate. You know, investors want to know, tell me what your total addressable market is. And they'll always be like, oh, you know, $3 billion or whatever.
The universe.
I'm going to get 50% of it. And it's like, you know, I actually want someone that has done that deep analysis and been like, okay, like, to be honest, this is how much the global market is. But for the first X years of my business, I'm only going to be in this one geography. And in this one geography, the total addressable market is this, but it's actually dominated by, you know, these players. And so realistically, what I can actually serve based on, you know, my target demographic is this, and this is what I project. That's where you're realistic. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Brandless went in there, guns blazing, going, yeah, I'm taking down Unilever, taking down Procter & Gamble, or whatever. And, you know, how easily are we willing to switch the things that we buy, like shower gel, shampoo, conditioner, especially if we're just like a middle-of-the-road consumer whose needs are already met by things that are on the shelves. Like, fair enough, if you have Afro hair or something more complex that isn't served by the incumbents. But, you know, ultimately, you're still going to the pharmacy to pick up your prescriptions, or, you know, going to the drugstore that's in the grocery shop as you're like getting food on your way home from work. There isn't enough incentive for me to invest in another subscription if I'm just like popping these things into my shopping basket on my way home from work anyway.
So let's have a quick business session strategy storming. Yeah, I'm gonna throw some ideas. Yeah, and you tell me if they're any good. Now, let's say I had 100 million sitting on deck and I was like, okay, cool, I'm gonna buy up all the remaining assets of Brandless, right? And I have seen people tweet, say like, who do I speak to buy up Brandless? And I'm thinking, what are you buying? The brand? Because it was meant to be Brandless. I don't understand. But anyways.
Rebrand
so anyways,
it.
Yeah, rebrand it. I don't know. So to me, what they did wrong is that they tried to make it a cheap alternative. So a lot of the items were priced at $3. But I'm thinking, if you're targeting millennials, make it something where it's like, it's more sustainable, make it something where it's more premium, make it something where it's more, you know, it's just a premium high-end product and it's got a minimalistic packaging. Then you're talking, but don't say, we're going to be no brand, we're going to be minimalistic and everything is dirt cheap. Because if I want cheap, I'm just going to go on Amazon. You know what I'm saying? True. That's the wrong consumer, right? So like,
exactly. Subscribe and
do you think I'm on the right tact? Am I on the right? Yeah, exactly. Am I on the right tact? Do you think that would have been a better strategy?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, we are more flexible when it comes to price. We don't have as that inelastic price as like previous generations that, you know, we've just gotten used to paying for the values that we subscribe to. And I think we're absolutely spot on.
Yeah, pass my avocado toast. That's what I'm talking about. Anyways. So you know what? On a separate but related topic, so an amazing black female founder, because it's related to what we mentioned before, called Jasmine Crowe. She's got a company called Gooda. I'm not too sure actually on the background of the company, but she's raised like I think a few million, and she basically tweeted out a horror story with her and a VC, essentially, where she didn't mention what the specific VC fund was. She said she had a meeting with a VC associate, so it wasn't a partner. And the meeting started off like any VC call would: company background, traction, revenue, etc. And then he said, the associate mentioned offhand, actually, we invested in another black female founder this year or last year, so I don't think we'll do a deal this year when you are raising.
Wow.
He let it slip. Now, that was either a, you know, a Freudian slip where he didn't mean to say that, or he just revealed an absolute concrete truth. Abba, how would you have reacted to a statement saying we've already given money to a black female founder, so actually we're not giving one to you? What do you say?
I would be like, thank you, next. Like, that is just game over for me. Anyone that's like tokenizing people in that way, or just making strategic decisions based solely on race and gender, to me inclines, y'all aren't making smart decisions here. I saw this tweet and I said as much to Jasmine. If there are people that are still saying, oh, but we've already got one, we filled our quota, that's just concerning. That's just worrying. It also makes me feel like they're just prioritizing the wrong things. I want investors that have a solid thesis backed by data, backed by insights into where the market is going, where opportunities are growing, and, you know, being able to predict the future. You know, I want them to have a vision of the future 10, 20, 50 years down the line that aligns with the causes I believe in and the trends I see. And if you are short-sighted enough to say, oh, we've already invested in one black woman for the year and that's done, then you're sleeping, man. You're sleeping. Because
do you think it's a situation where they view investing in black founders, or, you know, underrepresented founders in general, as charity, and that essentially it's a PR move, and that we've done our one for the year, therefore we can move on? Do you think that's what it is?
There's like a very, very strong current of discrimination in that statement, because it's exactly as you said. I've ticked that box. I've done that. I only did it so I could say that I've done one, and now I've done that one. I'm not interested. I don't really take people from this background seriously as investment opportunities. So, you know, I've done my one and that's it. What do you think?
I agree. Yeah. I think they were actually fortunate that she didn't expose who the VC fund was, because that could really have, like, you know, sent shockwaves and damaged the reputation of that specific VC firm.
But would it?
Maybe you're right. Like, maybe you're right. Maybe I'm too optimistic.
The frustrating thing about being underrepresented is the fact that while we are able to mobilize change when we move through the grassroots, even then it's still challenging. And even then we are still not the gatekeepers. You know, we are still not the gatekeepers. And this is what's so tough about being black in tech, or being gay in tech, a lesbian in tech, or whatever, you know, underrepresented identity you fall into, or identities you fall into. Because when you look at who's in charge and who holds power, it's almost always still white men. Okay, some of them are gay white men. Some of them are like working class white men, but for the most part, they're still white and they're still men. And when we start saying things like, oh, don't go to XYZ Capital because they said something that's sexist and racist, guess what? XYZ Capital can turn around to all their other peers and be like, she's toxic. Don't touch her with a 10-foot pole. I didn't even say anything racist to her. I didn't even say anything sexist to her. And now look at her. Now guess what? XYZ, like, Capital telling all their people. And let's be real for a minute. When it comes to emotion, who do we trust? We're not trusting the data. We're trusting the people that we know. And I'm just speaking from my own personal experience. Like, every time that I have spoken out and been like, hey, excuse me, I'm being treated really unfairly here, no one came to have my back. And that's why I built Hustle Crew, and that's why I started building communities. Because when I looked around the workplace and I was like, hey, other women, someone's just harassed me, no one had my back. Because all it took was that person to be like, she's lying. And no one believes women in our society. Like, it's so hard for us to believe women. And it's even harder if they're black.
Shout out to Hustle Crew, man. So the other thing I wanted to talk about was, there's this common narrative that gets spun out by a lot of right-wing media personalities, this idea of a narrative violation. So they'll quote tweet like an article that maybe goes against what might be seen as like a left-wing narrative, and they'll say, oh, it's a narrative violation. But this is the ultimate narrative violation that I've seen, basically. So, yeah, I know, so it's, yes, isn't you, because listen, I don't blame you for not knowing any of this rubbish. But anyways, the stat came out that US entrepreneurship is near a 40-year low. So essentially, the narrative violation is that a lot of VCs will just be like, listen, we're in the golden age of entrepreneurship. We're funding all these companies, right? You know, it's never been easier to be an entrepreneur. Technology has democratized access to entrepreneurship. You can start a website. You can start a Shopify store. You don't necessarily have to work for the man no more. You can do your own thing. It's never been easier, blah, 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 blah. But actually, the data shows that it's a 40-year low in people starting companies. This is US-centric data. So we're going to have to put on our US, you know, centric lenses, right? The article basically, and the article essentially says, you know, things like the fact that it's, you know, this is an old trend, but like, you know, Walmart and Amazon have basically made it harder for you to start up a little mom and pop shop. Software has made it harder for you to be like a little solo accountant, for example. And yeah, I mean, is there anything else that comes to mind where you might be like, okay, this is actually an impediment to entrepreneurship? Because even me, I'm not going to lie, I got suckered into this belief because I thought, yeah, I started a company and I couldn't have done this company that I'm doing right now 10, 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago. So it is easier. But I don't know. What do you think?
So do I feel it's harder to be an entrepreneur? I mean, it's so difficult over that timeline because I'm not even 40 years old. And I think that is one of the tough things about macro trends, that it requires you to zoom out to a point where it's actually like extremely hard to comprehend. I was speaking to John Henry of Harlem Capital for the Product Hunt podcast yesterday, and he was saying how when he first went into business, you know, well over 10 years ago, he wasn't really thinking about it in the scale of, I need to build a unicorn, I need to get venture funding, I need to dominate the market. He was just like, I'm just going to like set out and do like a small thing, make some money, see where it goes. And he says like the narrative now is very much, you know, unicorn or bust. And I think in that sense, that could be why we have fewer people participating in it, because, you know, entrepreneurship has become a career path. It's like well publicized. The media love to glorify the people who have sort of got rich, quotation marks, overnight. And I can see how that might put people off trying to pursue just building like a small or medium-sized enterprise, because you're just like, okay, I either choose this highly risky, volatile, intensive path of sort of becoming the next Mark Zuckerberg or whatever, or I just get a job. And it almost feels like there's no in-betweens, because it's so unusual for us to throw the spotlight on people that are just building sustainable businesses.
Yeah, so there's two points that was also raised, and I think have some validity to it. One is that the companies that are big now, so the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Teslas, they're much more innovative than old big companies like IBM back in the day. So they're much more able and quicker to spin out their own version or something. So for example, Facebook can spin out of a clone of Snap. Okay, that fails, but then they can just integrate Snap's features into Instagram, for example. So these big companies are much quicker to kind of destroy and decimate newer companies, basically. You haven't seen a new company form in the social, you know, mobile space in a long time, because everyone's just, you know, shit afraid of Facebook, essentially. The other thing, which is definitely US focused, is that what I don't understand is, if I didn't have my healthcare guaranteed, I wouldn't start a company. That's the absolute God's honest truth. Here in the UK, we are lucky. We have like a national health service. So whether I'm employed or unemployed, I've got healthcare. You know what I'm saying, right? Whereas in the States, it's like, well, you know what? Yeah, gap between the rich and poor is bigger than ever it's ever been before. And you're on your own. And if you leave your job, you're not getting healthcare. So why would anybody take the risk, really, of starting a company? Do you see what I mean? Like, it's almost tantamount to like recklessness to be like, okay, I'm leaving my job, and if I get ill, you know, God help me, essentially, right? I think the fact that the Democrats are pushing for, you know, all the candidates seem to be pushing for some kind of form of universal healthcare or some kind of closer to it, right? I think it will help entrepreneurship. And that's what a lot of people don't understand about, you know, these right wings. They'll be like, socialism. But actually, these type of programs help capitalism. They make people more likely to become entrepreneurs.
Shout out to our sponsor, MIT, who needs no introduction. They are hiring for a remote senior staff writer. They need you under minimal supervision. Write articles on a variety of emerging technology topics while ensuring a consistent style, voice, and quality matching MIT Horizon requirements. Link for the position in the show notes.
Have you seen this new Malcolm X documentary on Netflix?
I have not. Have you?
Yeah, so it's called Who Killed Malcolm X? And essentially, they reveal actually who are the actual gunmen behind, you know, Malcolm X's assassination. It turned out the people that went to jail for his murder, a lot of them were innocent, and they were the actual killers were roaming the street to this day. But that's not the main point I wanted to make. There's a few points. One, essentially, Malcolm X died penniless and homeless. His actual killers were kind of protected and celebrated within their community of Newark. People knew who the person was that actually killed him, and actually just kind of, you know, allowed him to kind of rebrand and live his life, essentially. Now, the only reason why I bring this up, I think everybody should watch the documentary full stop, because it's a very, you know, important historical documentary. But I think it made me stop and ponder, where I was like, I understand now why people are like, you know what? I'm just trying to get my money. F helping people, because a lot of times our leaders and like the people that are putting everything on the line to help people,
targeted,
they end up not just targeted, they end up abandoned by the very community they seek to help. Nobody protects them. They end up penniless, their families at risk. And it's like, wow, man, we've got to really do a better job of protecting, you know, our so-called leaders. I don't know. Is anything I'm saying have any validity? Because it's just like, sometimes I see the conversation on Twitter and people are like, oh, black capitalism, bun you, black capitalist, whatever, forget you guys, Jay-Z and Diddy. And I'm like, well, what do you want them to do? You want them to be like Malcolm and end up dead and homeless and penniless and their killers celebrate?
I feel that it's falling too much into that binary view of thinking. Like, helping people and then I'm ending up, you know, exposed, broke, penniless, and, you know, spent all my energy helping people and I didn't spend any enough time looking after myself. Or it's, I'm going to abandon all sense of community and just do me. And I feel like there is some medium place between those two things. I think we are good examples of that. Like, I'm not saying we're perfect and, you know, nor are we like super rich or anything like that. But on the one hand, you know, we're working, we're building sustainable businesses, we're generating like income, we're like hiring people from our community into our company, so we're reinvesting in that. But at the same time, we're using the platform that we've made to shine a light on uncomfortable issues that we feel should be discussed so that we can create lasting change. And I do feel, you know, we're very fortunate to live in a time where that's possible. We're very fortunate to live in a time where, you know, I can work at a company but also have views that are my own and express those views openly without, you know, risking losing my job. And I don't think that was something that previous generations could necessarily do. I also think, you know, I'm not about the short term. You know, neither of us are. Like, we accepted that when we started our companies, and we accepted that when we decided to work in diversity as opposed to selling shoes or like whatever. We both realized that if we want things to be better in the future than they are right now, we're going to have to operate in a difficult space. Like, you and I both could be making way more money if we were doing other things, but we chose to work in diversity inclusion for a reason. And so I just think, like, you know, especially seeing what's happening in the UK and the US, you know, I see a lot of people saying we're living in the golden age of white collar crime. It's not only us and our community saying, I got to do me. You know, we see people in the most powerful positions of government across the world going, I need to fill my pockets and I need to help my friends fill theirs. You know, this is just a human nature thing. We are greedy. We are greedy, greedy people, and we always want more. But I just think it's a cop out. For me, it's a cop out if you're just like, oh no, I need to do me. I need to look after, you know, myself, my people, and I can't participate in the greater good and in the greater cause, because that's just how we end up. To be honest, that's probably how we ended up where we are right now.
Yeah, you know what? You're 100% right. I don't think it's something where, you know, I fully bought into that whatsoever, but watching that documentary, I was just like, oh, I can understand sometimes a bit more now after seeing that. But you're right. It's all about balance. And I think it's possible to kind of find that middle ground between making sure that, you know, you're okay and your family is okay, and at the same time serving, you know, your community. But I do think when you watch the documentary, it's a thing where we as a community have to do better by the people that are actually trying.
Yes, because, exactly.
And that's the ultimate lesson. It's not necessarily everybody, you know, I'm doing me, but I think, you know, we've got to be like, okay, cool. Who are the people that are actually putting themselves at risk and doing, you know, doing work for the community at their own expense? Like, can we make sure they're okay? Because otherwise, how do we, you know, incentivize anybody else to step up and help?
And, you know, who do we stand for and what do we stand up against? Like, each of us as individuals have to know that deep down and stay true to it, because otherwise you just end up lost.
Yo, that's this episode of Techish wrapped up. We'll catch you next week. Use the hashtag Techish to give us a hit up and chat to us. Support us on Patreon, patreon.com/techish, and we'll see you next week.
Peace.
Bye.